Hello, hello. Welcome back to the 18th episode of the Hex and Cube podcast, a podcast mostly about Euro board games and the people who design them. I am your host, Kyle Schubert, and tonight is the night of nights. We have a very special guest, Jeremy Lowndes, on the show. Jeremy, glad to have you on, man.
Thanks, Kyle. Hi, everybody.
So I met Jeremy through the Game Crafter community, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and he's been so kind to have been a playtester for one of my games, which is awesome. And as I've gotten to know him a little bit, I could just see his excitement for abstract games, and so I wanted to have him on the show tonight to talk about just that. And if you don't know, the abstract game is like the Euro game's cousin, and it's like that cousin that is really blunt and straight to the point. Like, they're the cousin that the rest of the family just knows that they're going to talk about, like, religion and politics at dinner. And then by the end of it, everyone will be fighting with each other. And so I personally like this cousin a lot. And so I'm pumped to chat with Jeremy about this cousin. So, Jeremy, before we get into our discussion tonight, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself with regards to things other than games? So, like, what do you do for a career? What's your family life like? Do you have any other hobbies or interests? Just go ahead and tell us about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, so I do IT, like a lot of, I think, my fellow board game designers out there. It seems like there's a good chunk of us that do IT or software development or business-related things. So I work for Michigan State University, and I manage a small IT team that supports the math department and the statistics and probability department. We have a lot of centralized IT as well, but we have people like myself who support units more directly, more hands-on with the faculty and staff in that department. So I really enjoy that and very thankful for that job. As far as personal life, I have a wonderful wife and five children, ages 12 to 3, and so they keep us both really busy, and we actually just got a puppy a few weeks ago, so that's been a lot of fun adding that to the mix. The puppy's actually sleeping on my lap right now, so I guess I'm more of a dog person than I realized. But yeah, so, you know, the kids love playing games with me, board games, and, you know, we play outside when the weather is nice and that sort of thing. Yeah, I do have other hobbies too, but it seems like they kind of come and go depending on the season, right? The most recent one, I've been doing some weightlifting in the garage since I used to play basketball, but with COVID and everything, decided contact sports probably indoors wasn't a great idea. So, been trying to do some exercising in the garage instead. So that's been interesting.
Man, I have a similar, like, I had just gotten back into basketball after not playing for a while, like right before COVID hit, and we had like this cool little, almost like a, you know, like a city league that was just kind of a pickup thing, and a bunch of guys and from the community would get together and play basketball, and it was like right before COVID hit, and so then that just fell apart, which was a bummer because I love basketball, and then it seems like my physical activity has plummeted since then. So that's great.
It's tough. Yeah, you got to be really intentional about it. Otherwise, it kind of just gets put on the back burner.
For real, so, for real.
I mean, I think having younger kids can help too, but
it can. Yeah, they definitely keep you active. My kids got into roller skating. We bought them skates for Christmas. And I used to do like aggressive inline back in the day. And
oh, wow.
And so I was like, oh, this is perfect. I'll get a pair of skates and we can all skate together. And the first day back at the skate park, I was like, wow, I feel older.
Muscles were sore that you forgot you had.
Man, yeah, and it took so much more effort to do everything. So
yeah,
that's fun. It's fun coming to grips with your own fragility and just everybody ages and that's part of life.
That's true.
So I always like to reiterate whenever I have a designer on the show that we as people are complex and we are more than just games. And so that's why I like to get to know my guests a little bit more. And sure. and so I have one question that could potentially be the most important question that I ask you all night. And that is, if you had to choose between ice cream and cheesecake, which would you choose?
I can see how that would be a deep question for many people. For me, being lactose intolerant, it's not quite as easy of a choice. I don't know of many, well, I'm sure there are lactose-free cheesecakes, but it's much easier to pick up a half gallon of lactose-free ice cream. So I would have to say ice cream, although I do miss cheesecake quite a bit. And it's only been the last 4 or 5 years that I found out that I'm lactose intolerant. So I can understand how that debate would be heated in some groups.
You know what's so funny? I was writing this question. I always like to ask just like stupid, like frivolous questions that are just fun to like, you know, get to know people with. And I was writing this one and I was like, you know what? He is going to have an intolerance. I just know he is. And this is going to be a ridiculous question. So that's wonderful that, I mean, it's not wonderful that you're lactose intolerant, but it's funny that that's what happened. And it is. Have you had cashew ice cream?
I have not. No,
it's pretty good. So I'm a fan of cashew milk. I like the creaminess of it, and it makes real good ice cream. So
cool. Yeah, well, I better check that out.
Yeah, it's good. Well, kind of as a transition into talking about game stuff, this is another fun question, but who are some designers that either you are excited about right now or have been really excited about in the past, game designers?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and I have to be honest, I really don't follow designers very closely at all. And that's probably to my own detriment. And it's like I only have so much time to play games and design games. So it seems like I kind of just fly by the seat of my pants. Whatever, you know, somebody gets as a gift, I'll check out, or you know, I'll browse the internet and add some things to my wish list, or, you know, look on some of the crowdsourcing sites and participate in that. But I haven't dove deep into following other designers' careers or games. And I really need to be better at connecting with people in the community too, because I know there's a lot of great designers out there that do that. So.
No, that's awesome. Like, I've heard numerous designers talk about the dilemma of like as you design games and as you design more and just depending on kind of the makeup of your life, you know, like how your time is divided throughout the whole of your life, you start to play less games and you start to like, you know, you're just not. The games that you are playing are either probably like in our case, you know, with our family, or you are playing prototypes. you know, you're either playing your own prototype or you're playing the prototype of a fellow designer, right? You're reciprocating, you know, the play testing. And so you just, I think that's a kind of a normal thing that happens to a lot of designers, even really, really prolific designers. And it probably is even maybe more common with designers who are prolific, that they just, end up playing prototypes and less games by published designers, or you know, at least published designers that don't have a prototype in front of them. So I totally get that, man. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about how you were introduced to board games and to like what we would maybe consider hobby games, and then how that transitioned into you deciding to, you know, design your own game and games.
Sure. So I can't remember when I'm exactly introduced to board games, you know, just growing up playing board games with brothers and sister and parents. You know, we'd always have some game going on, seems like, since I grew up with six brothers and one sister. So a large family, and we didn't do a lot of video games really. So it was either playing outside or doing board games. So, you know, we did a lot of the, you know, Monopoly and Sorry and Clue, checkers, chess, those kind of traditional board games. And then, you know, as I got older and my coworker started introducing me to some of the more modern board games. So, you know, he showed me Hive and we played Agricola and I can't remember. There's so many that we played over lunch break. So that's been a lot of fun kind of getting reintroduced to some of these over the last few years. And then I started, you know, thinking, well, man, this is probably something that I could do, right? It's just like create one of my own. And so I was like, if I ever, so I kind of planned backwards a lot of times. So I thought, well, if I ever did have a game that was published worthy, you know, how could I get it produced? And so that's when I stumbled on the Game Crafter, and then I subscribed to their email newsletter. And before you know it, I'm trying to come up with a design for one of their contests. And this, I was so naive. Like, I thought it would be so cool to like design this game. And of course, in my mind, it was going to be awesome. Like the best game ever. I was going to surprise everybody. I wasn't going to tell people I was working on this game. I was just going to spring it on everybody. And you know, what I found out later is I really kind of undercut myself, because I didn't have playtesters and I didn't have the feedback that I could have had to make the game actually better. And so, you know, the game still works, but there's things that, you know, I look back on now and be like, yeah, it could have been better if it was more than just my immediate family giving me feedback on it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's funny how, I just listened to a podcast not that long ago, and it had a person that was involved in like the mass market side of board games. So, you know, like Hasbro and you know, companies like that. And she was saying that the community for like what we would consider hobby games versus the community that is around like mass market games are totally different. And mass market games, like that community and industry, is very like closed door, and like you don't share your ideas with anybody. Everything's really hush hush. You know, you get patents on things. You know, it's not collaborative.
Sure.
And then like the hobby space is like the exact opposite of that. Everybody's very open about everything. You know, you try to involve as many people as you can on your in the design process, everybody's just throwing ideas off of each other. But like, if you, you know, if you're not exposed to that or you're not aware of that, it's something that you just, like you did, you kind of just have to like jump in and then discover that for yourself.
Right.
But it's cool. I mean, you know, everybody is very, kind and welcoming, and people just want to like help you make your game and your idea the best that it possibly can be, which is pretty right. cool.
And everybody has their own ideas too, right? So it's not like
yeah.
by throwing your idea out there, someone's going to take it and steal it yeah. because if they're like me, they already have like 12, 13 or more other games that they wish they had time to work on. They're not going to have time to take your idea.
Seriously. And run
with it, so.
Yeah. The idea is like 10% of the process.
Yeah.
Like,
and it changes so much too.
Yeah. If you throw out an idea and then somebody steals that idea and like goes and actually makes the game all the way to completion, honestly, they deserve the credit for that because,
right.
you know, there's so much work that goes into that. The idea part is like, you know, it's like a dime a dozen kind of thing.
Right.
So is the game that you were just talking about, was that Deco? Was that your first design?
It was.
Cool. Yeah. So yeah, go ahead and tell us a little bit about Deco and kind of how it started and sure. What happened with the game and kind of, you know, maybe where it's at right now.
Cool. Yeah. So Deco was born out of the brainstorming when I learned about the Game Crafters contest that they were running, and the theme of the contest was elegance.
Mm.
And so in my mind, what can be more elegant than a game where you are creating patterns? And so I went through a bunch of iterations of tile laying game where you are basically racing to build a pattern. Now, I know it sounds very similar to, what's the name of that other really popular game? Azul?
Azul, yeah.
Yeah. So I must have seen that game at some point and had some inspiration from it because, I don't come up with brand new ideas out of thin air, right? But I hadn't actually played Azul at that point. But it's different. I mean, it's when you place the tiles, you're actually building off of the same shared arrangement as all the other players.
Mm.
So you're not building like your own little pattern. So you can basically try to block other people from building their pattern as well, because you can see everybody has some goal cards in front of them to which pattern they want to create. And so you can not only, you know, build your pattern, but you can also strategically try to keep them from completing theirs. And there's different actions you can take depending on the tile too. Like some of them you can move a tile, some you can rotate, things like that. So it's pretty straightforward, but it's fun. It's definitely, nothing that's going to win some huge rewards or anything, but the kids come back to it, and you know, I've sold a few just through the Game Crafter to friends and family, and they seem to enjoy it, so I'm proud of it. I don't think that it's gonna, you know, go any further. I've done a few like offshoots using the same name. Like I have another one called Trideco, which is fits in a little mint tin because the Game Crafter had a mint tin contest, so I wanted to make a game that fit in a mint tin. And so I did another pattern building one, but this one's a little different. It's for three players, and same idea where you're building a pattern, but this one you're trying to make the largest pattern, and then you can kind of like overlap each other's colors and whatnot. So yeah, it's, in my mind, it all looks really elegant on the table as you're playing it.
Mm.
And there's a lot of strategy behind it too. And so in my mind, that fits the elegant theme.
Awesome. And how did it, How did it do in the Simple Elegance contest? Do you feel like what were some things that you, I guess, learned from that, or maybe wish that you would have done differently? Tell us about that experience.
No, that's a good question. It's been a couple years now. I made it past the first round of voting, the community voting.
Awesome.
I did receive a lot of feedback that, you know, abstract games are difficult to bring to market, you know, because they don't really have that theme or that story that kind of drives it. And it just seemed like people thought it would just kind of get lost in the shuffle of other games that are available out there that are in the abstract family. So that was probably the thing that I took away from the most. And, you know, maybe looking back, if I would have play tested it with more people ahead of time, maybe I could have received that feedback and tried to build some sort of a story around it. Although, you know, that might have changed the mechanics of the game too. I'm not sure. But that's probably the feedback that stuck out the most. And like I said before, probably the thing that I learned the most was play test more often and with more people instead of trying to, you know, keep it a secret.
Yeah. That's good. So then let's talk a little bit about abstract games. In the context of the board gaming hobby, how would you define an abstract game? Like, what are some of the characteristics or definitives of an abstract game, just to give our listeners kind of a definition for what we're talking about?
Sure. So I think, this can vary. Obviously, you know, people are going to have, you know, different definitions.
Yeah.
Maybe want to be more specific. But I think most abstract games are ones that don't rely on luck.
Mm.
Some of them are going to have perfect information where you know, like chess or checkers, where you can see everything. There's no roll the dice or draw the card or a hand that's hidden from the other players. So either perfect information or minimize the luck aspect of it. And then also, they don't really rely on a theme at all or a story. So the theme, if there is a theme, it's going to be very, you know, surfacey. Like, you know, if you take chess, for example, it's, you know, two armies facing off, and it's like, okay, I mean, you could make up another story just as much, you know, just as easily and plug it in, right? And then I think also another large part of abstract games would be the strategy. So you have lots of different possibilities, lots of different choices to make.
So do you think that the theme, it's interesting that you brought up theme earlier, and your definition of part of your definition of an abstract game is that it doesn't rely on theme or tap into theme very much. And what's interesting is that all board games are literally abstracted to some degree, right?
Of course, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like varying levels of abstraction. The closest thing that we get to really like true to theme games are like simulations.
Right.
And so the genre of abstract game is almost like the opposite of that, where oftentimes, like you're saying, there just is no theme at all, right? It's colors and shapes and abstract pawns and pieces. And I totally agree that some of the defining characteristics are things like perfect information or the strategic nature of the game. And I would even add to that generally abstract games are very tactical as well. You're not only devising a strategy, but you're also from turn to turn responding to the moves of your opponent. Would you agree with that?
Right. Yeah, the game state is going to change quickly sometimes. And yeah. You may have like a pivotal moment where there's no such thing as a catch-up mechanism at that point. Like in chess, for example, if you make a mistake and your opponent notices your mistake and capitalizes on it, you're likely might as well resign at that point. And you'll see that a lot in tournaments where the person who blunders will resign fairly quickly because it's almost an insult to continue playing the match at that point, because you're basically saying to the other person, you know, that you don't think that they're smart enough to win with the huge advantage.
Yeah, you're almost just wasting their time.
Right.
That's awesome. And you actually, that's another great point, and probably another characteristic of abstract games is that they're very skill based. Mm-hmm. And so I would probably argue that a skilled player versus a novice, the skilled player is going to win, you know, almost every time.
Right. And that can be a big drawback, actually.
Sure.
And a reason that games may have a harder time taking off in the market.
Yeah.
Because who wants to, you know, go over to a friend's house who is really good at Hive and play Hive and just get spanked?
Yeah. Yeah, which in turn, I mean, depending on who you're playing an abstract game with, it can either be a huge bummer or it can make the experience amazing. You know, if you have a couple people that are very interested in a highly competitive gaming experience, right?
Sure.
Because abstract games are obviously highly competitive because of the skill factor. And so, you know, if you have some friends or people that you know that are highly competitive, abstract games are generally a great way to have that kind of experience.
For sure.
So, you know, what aspects of abstract games appeal to you personally? What are some things about abstract games that you personally enjoy?
Personally, I think the strategy aspect of it, and knowing that I'm not the fate of the game isn't going to be on the dice roll or the card that I draw.
Mm.
I'd much rather play a game where the skill of me or my teammate is what's going to determine the outcome. Even if that means I lose, it means I have a chance to at least learn and be better next time. So I think that aspect of it appeals to me the most. And just like thinking through all the different possibilities, like, you know, I usually have at least one or two games of chess going on using the chess.com. And so, you know, I can look at the board and study it for a while and then set it aside and come back and just, you know, look at it some more and then finally make a choice before my time runs out. So I like to be, I don't know, analysis paralysis is actually something I enjoy when I'm the one that's taking my sweet time to make a move.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I
know for other people it can be very frustrating to sit there and be like, come on, make a move. But you can do timed games too, of course.
Yes.
And just say there's a limit on how much time you have to make a choice. And that can actually add a whole element of excitement too.
Mm. Yeah, and you bring up another aspect of abstract games with regards to because it's skill-based, another kind of benefit of an abstract game is that, like you said, even if you get stomped, let's say you play a game for the first time and the other player just destroys you, like, you can get better at the game.
Right.
There are some games where you know, you may be able to get better at the game, but usually the ceiling is lower, right?
Mm-hmm.
With abstract games, many times, just because of their nature, there is no ceiling, or the ceiling is so much higher. And so you can always progress and get better and learn, you know, learn new tactics and new moves. And because so much of it is playing against your opponent, you kind of are just always evolving as a player. The more you play it, the better you're going to get at it.
Right. And it's interesting, too, because sometimes you have to almost study your opponent.
Yeah.
And know them. So, you know, when I play a friend, you know, at one game and then different friend of the same game, they might have totally different strategies and approaches to it. And I can alter my strategy if I can recognize the patterns that they use.
Yes. And that's what's cool about this is that even though there's no what we would call luck or randomness, there still is uncertainty, right? Your opponents are the wild cards. There may be moves that are optimal, at least in your eyes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your opponent is going to see that move or perceive that move as being the most optimal. And so there's still that level of kind of excitement in the unknown as your opponent is deciding what they're going to do, because they may throw you for a loop.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And so, like you said, you kind of have to learn to adapt to whatever your opponent is doing or not doing, depending on on the situation.
Right.
So what would you say, as somebody who has designed an abstract game, what would you say are some of the challenges to designing an abstract game? And what would you say, like, what's at the heart of a compelling abstract game? Like, what makes a good abstract game, and what are some challenges to designing said abstract game?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say the analysis paralysis is definitely one thing to watch out for. You don't want to give so many choices that the players are, you know, taking a long time to decide, or they don't know, they don't have a way to decide what to do. They're just kind of guessing at what to do. So that's definitely something to watch out for. Another one is like finding the right balance and making sure that the first player doesn't have a large advantage right off of the bat. Because, you know, that can be frustrating for the other players, obviously, if they feel like, you know, right out of the gate, they can't do anything to even out the game. But then also you have to watch out for stalemates. So if everybody plays optimally, are you going to end up in a stalemate most of the time? You know, like say tic-tac-toe. I mean, obviously that's a really simple example, but you know, if people know what they're doing, tic-tac-toe ends up in a draw every time.
Yeah. Yep.
So the perfect information part is probably that more pertains to perfect information games more so than just abstract in general. But I think that you still have to watch out for those things, those pitfalls. I'm not sure if I'm qualified to get in any more details, or I can't really think of other things off the top of my head right now.
Yeah, those are great. And honestly, I love that you brought up the first player dilemma, because even like, you know, so I design almost entirely what I would consider Euro games. So usually, you know, resource management, also very minimal luck, if any. But you know, usually there's a lot of stuff going on, but that's a problem that I deal with, in designing Euro games. And I imagine that in abstract games, it's even heightened, because that man, it nothing sours a gaming experience for me than when like you get into the game and you go, wow, this game was decided by who went first.
Right.
Or who went second or however the turn order was laid out. So I think that is a dilemma and a problem that designers of probably most games, at least on the, you know, strategic low luck side of game design, that they have to deal with and wrestle with, and is kind of an opportunity for some really innovative ideas and really creative mechanisms and systems.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the ways that I'm trying to approach this, I haven't brought this up yet, but I'm working on another abstract game called Duin.
Mm.
And it actually won the, I don't know if you know Chris Anderson, he has a game design blog, and a game design podcast, the Board Game Workshop.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So he runs what he calls a design competition. It's more of like a system for getting really good feedback. And there's like different rounds of the competition. They kind of narrow the field every time. So I actually entered Duin last, let's see, when did it start? I think it was just before COVID. And it did really well in the competition. And I got some amazing feedback on it. But anyway, long story short, it still has a ways to go. I'm trying to build an AI engine in Python so that I can actually let the computer play itself thousands of times to find out what happens as I tweak the rules. So
that's awesome.
Does the first player win, 80% of the time, or does it end in a stalemate 50% of the time? Does it, what strategies does the computer find out after playing itself over and over? So I'm probably, 60% done with that, of the AI part of it. Mm. And then I'll just have to start tweaking the rules from there until I find that balance.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about that.
That's awesome. And do you feel like you have come up with a solution to that first player issue?
So I don't know if it's an issue right now. My playtests, it's not obvious.
Yeah.
In the playtests that the first player has a huge advantage. There is a small one, I would say, for sure.
Mm.
I have a couple ideas on, maybe how to mitigate that as far as, letting, the second, the player who goes second. This is a two-player game. So if you don't move first, then, maybe you place two pieces on, or if you do go first, you can only place your first explorer with a 4 power instead of 6 or something like that. So, I'm sure there's going to be a solution to it.
Cool.
It's just a matter of finding the time to finish my AI engine or have a lot more time to play test.
Dude, that crazy robot engine thingy sounds awesome.
Well, I figure it's a skill that is valuable to have. So
yeah,
maybe I should get it wrapped up, but
time. Yeah. So you alluded to this a little bit earlier. You started talking about it, but, this would definitely apply to publishers, but even people that are self-publishing or putting a game on the Game Crafter or running a Kickstarter or whatever. But in your perspective, like, what are some of the challenges to marketing an abstract game?
Boy, that's another good question. I mean, I don't know what the answer is to marketing any game, let alone an abstract. I mean, I could guess that an abstract game is going to have more hurdles because it's appealing to a narrower market, somebody who wants a very, you know, skill-based game that you're looking to really invest time into to get better at. It's not just a casual game you're going to pick up with your friends and play necessarily. You're going to be investing some more time into getting good at it, and you'll need some opponents that are willing to do the same.
Yeah. And I think you brought up the theme thing earlier, and, you know, certainly people, I would assume, and I think from what I've, you know, researched and learned, and just from being a human, that people are drawn to story. People are drawn to vibrant art or vibrant aesthetic. And while abstract games often have a clean graphic design to them, they're usually not maybe what we would consider vibrant in terms of art. And so there's not really a lot of like we were saying, theme there for players to grab a hold of.
Right.
And so I feel like that is one thing that would be challenging. I also, and maybe you would agree or disagree with this, but I think a lot of people who are really excited about abstract games, and maybe these people wouldn't even know to call it an abstract game, but people that are interested in that kind of experience often, you know, maybe experience chess or a game like chess, and then they're like, I've found the game, and so I don't need anything else, right? I have chess, and I get that kind of experience from chess, so I don't really need anything else, and there's really no need for me to explore beyond that because I'm satisfied with that experience.
I agree with that for sure. I mean, there's people that spend their whole life just learning chess and mastering that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, and that's awesome. Like if chess is enough for you, rock on. But what's cool is that, like, even within the genre of abstract games, there's so much more out there. There's so many like unique and interesting ways in which people have created a similar experience, but in so many different formats and so many different ways. But once people find the thing that they're going to invest time in, often, you know, they it's hard for them to go beyond that. Like you said, who has the time to dedicate to all these different games?
For sure. It'll be interesting to see, you know, if you could look down the corridor of time and, you know, what games are people going to be playing in 200 years, right? Like which ones are going to survive that length of time?
Yeah, for real. Maybe someday people will forget about chess and they'll just play Deco.
I doubt that.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend this was a handful of episodes ago, but we were talking about chess, and chess, I would argue, has endured partly because of kind of the heirloom nature of it, right? Like my friend actually told us that the set of chess that he had was like this really elaborate set, and it was handed down by his grandfather. And I feel like it's a game that is like passed down from generation to generation, and that's one of the ways in which it endures from generation to generation.
Yeah, you can't replace that for sure.
Exactly. So, you know, in 200 years, chess is probably still going to be hanging around, but maybe we'll have some other games that have joined the echelon.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the ones that we're playing now are in that category. So it'll be cool.
Yeah.
Of course, we won't be around to see it, but our...
man, who knows? Modern technology, we'll see, right?
There's some optimism for you.
Yeah, it's feigned optimism. I don't actually believe that. So what are some of your what are some of your favorite abstract games, and like what are some that maybe you would recommend to people if they want to maybe discover some maybe less mainstream abstract games? What would you recommend?
Let's see. So this is kind of showing my rookie status in the game design world, because I don't have all that many games to mention here. But I mean, obviously, chess, as we've talked about, is the classic. A newer one that I've really enjoyed is Hive. Mm. So if you haven't seen that one before, it's brilliant. And it's another one where the theme fits well with the pieces, because you have insects and you have six-sided pieces that you're building or placing on the surface. So the theme fits well. You could replace it with something other than insects and it would still work, but it is a great abstract game and a very a lot of depth to the strategy there. So I'd definitely recommend people check that one out. There's also an old school one called Quirkle. I don't know if you've ever come across this one before.
No.
But it's pretty cool. It has, you're basically matching based on shape, color, or what was the other one? I can't remember now. But there's different ways to match the tiles that you place out. And so you can score in different ways by matching those in a row. So that's a good one as well.
Quirkle. Gonna have to check that one out.
Yeah.
Well,
and there's a couple on my wish list that I'm eyeing. But we'll see. And then, of course, you know, Go, that's a huge one. I've played that a few times. But as I've been researching the whole machine learning side of things, the Google developed this AlphaGo program that beats the best Go players. So this was a more recent accomplishment. I mean, computers have been able to beat humans in chess for a few years now, but it's more recently that they've been able to beat them consistently in Go. So that one has even more, I don't know what you would say, depth or branching than chess has even.
Dang.
It's
like
crazy.
Some Matrix stuff, right?
Yeah. And then another one that I have on my list that I want to check out that I haven't had a chance to yet is called Yinch. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's Y-I-N-S-H. Have you played that one?
I haven't played it, but that designer, who his name escapes me, but there's like a whole line of games that are like, you know, the five letter words, and he has like a whole line of abstract games, and I've played Czar, which is one of his, but I haven't played Yinch yet.
Okay. Yeah, this one looks really interesting. So, I mean, there's, like you said, there are so many abstract games to check out, and just do a Google search for top abstract games and you'll get a different top 10 list depending on whose blog you land on.
For real. Yeah, there's a lot. And it's crazy because it's such a, in many ways, it's such a simple format, and yet, like, people have just created so many interesting games with so few components and few mechanisms, and they've managed to create, like you said, so much depth in the gameplay. It's fascinating. It's amazing.
Right.
So, are you working on anything right now? Do you have any games in the works? It sounds like you had a game that entered in, well, it was in the board game workshop. What's it
called? Yeah, the board game workshop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. What happened with that game? And do you have anything else going on right now?
Yeah, so it won that competition.
Oh, let's go.
So, yeah, that was exciting. And it's given me a lot of motivation to get it done. And I'm not sure if I'll self-publish it or try to pitch it to some publishers. I'm not sure. But yeah, I'd really like to see that one go to market. It's going to be a little bit challenging because the board pieces are kind of large because I built it out of wood, but it kind of like stacks into like a pyramid type shape, or you can rearrange it into other shapes as well, mm-hmm. depending on, you know, how you want to play. So yeah, it definitely recommend, if people are interested in that, just do a search. It's DUWEN. And if you just search on YouTube, you can get a little preview of it. So
awesome. Yeah. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So,
and you can play it for free too on, Tabletop Simulator.
Nice.
So, yeah, I can put that link out there if you want as well. And it'd be really cool if I could like actually create like an app for it, you know, so you could play it. And, but like I said, I really need to really hone the rule set down, and I got some amazing feedback from the competition. So need to try to integrate some of that into the rules too, and tweak it and do some more play testing. But yeah, I'd love to see that one take off. It's one of those ones that I think would look really good, like on a coffee table. So you can kind of like chess, right? Where you have it set up and it almost is like a decoration, just kind of begging to be played sitting there.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my dream for that one.
Do you have any interest in self-publishing?
I mean, just to make it available for friends and family.
Gotcha.
I think, yes, I do. You know, that's what I've done with Deco and Trideco. And I had my other game that I did on the Game Crafter contest was Fruit for All. It was just a fun party card game. That one actually won first place in their design competition. What was the name of the – I can't remember the theme for that contest off the top of my head now. If I thought about it for a minute, I'd remember.
No big deal. Just win.
Oh, the social deduction. So Heather Newton was the judge for that, and she gave me some really great feedback, but it really didn't technically meet her idea of social deduction because it's more of like a bluffing game than actual social deduction. But she ended up picking it as the winner after all. So
that's awesome.
I'm holding out hope that a publisher might be interested in it, but I don't know. It'll probably just end up in my self-published game selection too.
Man, well, if conventions start opening back up, you just got to hit up a couple of those and do some speed pitching events, right, or whatever.
Yeah, for sure.
Because those, I mean, both of those sound great. I'm sure you could find some interested parties.
Yeah, I have like the whole, like, if you remember that the packs of gum that you can buy that are fruity flavored and it's like a rainbow of colors and stuff. I kind of went off of that, played off of that theme for Fruit for All. And so it was very colorful. And I don't know. To me, it would be a no-brainer for someone to publish. But I know they have hundreds of people pitching ideas to them. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. Keep at it, man. I'm sure you'll find somebody.
Thanks.
Yeah, man. So if people want to follow what you are doing or just get in touch with you, you know, have a chat, where can they do that at?
Probably the best place is on Twitter. My handle is at Arctech LLC. That's ARQTEQ _LLC. And I haven't posted on there in a while, but I do respond to direct messages, and I'll try to post some more interesting updates here as I have them.
Awesome, man. Well, I think that is going to be a wrap for us tonight. Jeremy, seriously, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a super good conversation.
Thank you, Kyle. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. And listeners, thank you for hanging out with us. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, there's a few things that would be very meaningful for me that you could do. Go ahead and rate and review the podcast on whichever platform you listen to it on. You can also join the Facebook group. There's some really super rad people over there that you can meet and talk with and hang out with. You can sign up for the newsletter, which is very important for what I am trying to do. I can then directly communicate with you. You can comment on the blog discussion page and add your voice to this episode. Be a part of the conversation there. And last but not least, you can just get in touch with me on all of the social medias or via email, as I would love to chat with you and get to know you a little bit better. We can talk about games or not talk about games. The choice is yours. And I'll leave you with some words of wisdom. People who live in glass houses should not throw rocks. And really, probably should not be throwing anything at all. And if we're honest, you probably should just get a different house. Like, it's only a matter of time before that thing shatters and somebody gets hurt. And who even builds houses out of glass? That's just a stupid idea. Peace.